American Free Press Audio Edition, Issue 39 and 40, September 23 and 30, 2019. Sanctuary insanity. Officials implementing sanctuary policies responsible for robberies, rapes, murders committed by illegals. By John Friend. The recent spate of brutal and ruthless crimes committed by illegal aliens living in the United States has proven once again how political correctness and the radical open borders agenda has harmed America and its citizens in immeasurable ways. In July of this year, 21-year-old Daniel Alejandro Alvarado Cooler was brutally murdered in a vicious gang-related stabbing in Baltimore County, MD. It was revealed that six of the seven suspects currently in custody in connection with the savage slaying are living in the U.S. illegally and are connected to the notoriously violent MS-13 gang. Police found Cooler's body outside of an apartment complex on July 31 with multiple sharp force injuries, according to reports. Law enforcement officials are certain the grisly murder was gang-related but are still investigating the official motive for the attack. All seven suspects arrested have been charged with first-degree murder and are being detained without bail at the Baltimore County Detention Center. "We know this group of individuals was conducting surveillance on him. They were watching him, following him," Jennifer Peach, a Baltimore County police officer, explained to Fox News, referring to the victim. "We know they watched as he left the laundromat and went back across the street to the apartment complex, and that is where some of those individuals accosted him. We know they used knives and multiple people stabbed him multiple times," according to the Baltimore Sun. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, has officially sued immigration detainers for the six suspects illegally residing in the country, with the aim of potentially allowing federal officials to take the six illegal aliens into federal custody for removal from the country. The news comes as officials in Montgomery County, MD, just north of Washington, D.C., once one of the most desirable counties in America to live in, announced that yet another illegal alien has been arrested and charged with rape, the ninth such case since July, according to local news reports. Conservative author and pundit Michelle Mulkin, a frequent contributor to Fox News and author of the recent book Open Borders Incorporated, Who's Funding America's Destruction?, spoke at a rally against illegal immigration in sanctuary cities in Montgomery County in mid-September, describing the once affluent suburb of the nation's capital as ground zero in the battle against illegal alien sanctuary. The rally took place on the steps of the Montgomery County Government Complex in Rockville, MD, and featured a number of prominent anti-legal immigration activists, including Tom Fitton of Judicial Watch. His organization has filed FOIA requests with Montgomery County to expose the extent of its sanctuary policies. "We've been battling sanctuary policies in Maryland and Montgomery County for too long," Fitton stated during the rally. "There's in-state tuition for illegal aliens, taxpayer subsidies to help illegal aliens find illegal work, and, most dangerous of all, these outrageous sanctuary policies that allow criminal aliens to prey on the innocent, both citizens and non-citizens alike." The Federation for American Immigration Reform, a leading nonpartisan public advocacy organization focused on reducing immigration, ending illegal immigration, and exposing the dangerous sanctuary city policies implemented by local and state authorities across the country, has published an extensive database documenting and highlighting serious crimes committed by illegal aliens residing in the U.S. in recent years. While acknowledging that the criminal cases highlighted by the database do not necessarily reflect the majority of those illegally residing in the U.S., it nevertheless demonstrates that better prevention of illegal immigration is a public safety issue. According to the organization's website, many of the crimes highlighted include rape, drunk driving, assault, and even murder, with some of the perpetrators having been deported from the country only to illegally re-enter to commit more crimes and take advantage of America's generous public welfare system. Despite the well-documented crimes committed by illegal aliens and the threat open borders poses to American sovereignty and American citizens, those exposing and taking a stand on these issues continue to be targeted by the fake news media and radical left-wing activist organizations. Following the publication of her recent book, which exposes how the radical left has facilitated and encouraged mass illegal immigration and open borders in the West. Malkin has gone on a speaking tour to promote the book and raise awareness of these issues. She continues to be smeared by biased left-wing media outlets and activist organizations as a white nationalist and a racist for pointing out facts about illegal immigration and sanctuary city policies. Malkin's parents are both from the Philippines. Additionally, Maureen Maloney, a prominent NGO mom whose son Matthew was killed by an illegal alien in 2011, was recently heckled and booed while testifying at the Massachusetts State House in opposition to a bill that would allow illegal aliens to obtain driver's licenses. She held up a photo of her son, who was hit by an illegal alien with a criminal record who was driving drunk at the time of the accident, and began her testimony, only to be interrupted by boos from some members of the audience. "It just made me more determined," Maloney told the Boston Herald in response. "I don't want other people to lose their lives like Matthew did. I don't want other families to go through the heartache that my family deals with, and that's where I get the strength and the stamina to keep doing this. What we need is more conspiracy theorists. Given what's been going on in the world today, if they aren't already, everyone in the United States should be a conspiracy theorist by now. We're not talking about patently false conspiracy theories, like the debunked Russiagate story that nearly everyone on the left glommed onto as an excuse for why Hillary Clinton lost the presidential election to billionaire real estate developer and game show host Donald Trump. We're talking about real conspiracies such as the recent death of pedophile Jeffrey Epstein. The multimillionaire had already been convicted of sexually assaulting underage girls, yet he was out on the street for some inexplicable reason." The former prosecutor, who had brought the case against Epstein, admitted during an interview recently that he had cut a sweetheart deal for Epstein because he was told Epstein belonged to intelligence and to leave it alone. "Of course, Epstein never stopped being a disgusting human being, and, as a result, he was arrested again earlier this summer and charged, again, with trafficking in and sexually abusing dozens more young girls. He was being held in the same New York City Metropolitan Jail that held some of the world's worst criminals, including drug lord Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, yet somehow, some way, he purportedly was able to take his own life. He had supposedly tried to commit suicide in late July, so he had been put on 24-hour suicide watch with two cameras facing him directly, but, again, somehow, some way, on August 10th. He managed to strangle himself, reportedly breaking multiple bones in his neck, and not one guard heard a thing or saw anything because, miraculously, the two cameras facing his cell malfunctioned at the exact same time. Some coincidence. And then there's the 9/11 conspiracy, which, even 18 years later, refuses to go away. Earlier this month, right before the anniversary of the September 11th attacks, researchers from the University of Alaska Fairbanks, UAF, working with architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, AE911 Truth, released an explosive report that destroys the official story of how the 47-story World Trade Center Building 7 collapsed. Here's what UAF civil engineering professor Leroy Halsey had to say about his team's findings in a press release. "Our study found that the fires in WTC-7 could not have caused the collapse recorded on video. We have a more detailed report by roving editor Mark Anderson on the UAF report in this week's issue on page 5. And that's not the only 9/11 conspiracy that won't die despite someone's best efforts. Just before the anniversary of 9/11, YouTube started pulling interviews with people who were directly involved with the arrest of likely Mossad agents on September 11, 2001. That included a popular interview, which was posted to YouTube, that our own Dave Gahary conducted with New Jersey Police Sergeant Scott DiCarlo, the officer responsible for capturing Sivan Kurzberg, Paul Kurzberg, Oded Elner, Yaron Shimul, and Omar Marchmari, the five Israelis from Urban Moving Systems, who had earlier in the day been seen filming and celebrating the collapse of the World Trade Center towers. Dave's interview had been conducted several years after that fateful day, and it has been online on different platforms for over a decade. Yet YouTube decided to remove this compelling evidence of possible Israeli foreknowledge of the September 11th attacks only days before the 9/11 anniversary this year. It's worth emphasizing here that one of the five men, Elner, actually admitted on Israeli television that the group was in New York for the purpose of documenting the event. The fact of the matter is we are coming from a country that experiences terror daily, Elner told an Israeli television talk show host. Our purpose was to document the event, and that brings us to our president, who has repeatedly sought to set up talks with some of this country's supposed enemies. Is it coincidence that, shortly before each high-level meeting, some terrible high-profile incident occurs, thus steering public opinion away from any hope of peace, whether it's Russia, Afghanistan, North Korea, Syria or Iran? Something always seems to make the front pages of major newspapers just as the president is set to sit down and talk. You'd almost think, based on what has happened, that certain powerful groups and individuals don't really want peace to break out around the world. One of our more popular books, Conspiracy Theory in America, softcover, 272 pages, $20, by Lance D. Haven Smith, documents how the CIA coined the terms conspiracy theory and conspiracy theorist to shut down critics of the Warren Commission's findings in the 1960s. Nearly six decades later, however, more and more Americans accept the existence of a deep state conspiracy by corrupt individuals working inside and alongside the U.S. government to manipulate events on a global scale, using wars, assassinations, kidnappings, and blackmail to accomplish their goals. Today, 65% of Americans believe something's not right about Epstein's purported suicide. About 45% say that we need another investigation of the September 11th attacks, and 51% believe that there was a conspiracy at play in the JFK assassination. That's proof that most Americans are, in fact, conspiracy theorists today, and the country's better off for it. Christopher J. Petherick, Executive Editor, Attorney General William Barr is a creature of the D.C. swamp. By Donald Jeffries, OFO. President Donald Trump's questionable cabinet selections, none was more puzzling than the choice to name veteran Bush insider William Barr as Attorney General. Barr served as Attorney General during the administration of President George H.W. Bush. Referred to by columnist William Sapphire as cover-up General Barr, he worked tirelessly to bury evidence linking Bush to the Iran-Contra scandal as well as to cover up the roles of other Reagan administration officials in arming the then friendly American asset Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. Barr advised Bush to pardon not only former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger, but, in his own words, about five others. Bush took his advice on Christmas Eve to escape more scrutiny from the press. As the New York Times noted, Mr. Weinberger was scheduled to stand trial on January 5 on charges that he lied to Congress about his knowledge of the arms sales to Iran and efforts by other countries to help underwrite the Nicaraguan rebels, a case that was expected to focus on private notes that contain references to Mr. Bush's endorsement of the secret shipments to Iran. Perhaps Barr's lowest moment came with his efforts to cover up the government's atrocious actions at Ruby Ridge, Idaho. A wildly disproportionate reaction to a sawed-off shotgun charge, which resulted from an undercover agent incessantly pressuring Randy Weaver to make the barrel shorter, resulted in an armed assault on the Weaver family's remote cabin on August 21, 1992. Barr, who served as Attorney General from 1991-93, was served with a 542-page report by his Justice Department, which detailed massive misconduct on the part of federal agents and recommended criminal charges against FBI officials involved. While Barr claimed not to have been directly involved in the Ruby Ridge fiasco, the Washington Post reported in 1995 that top officials of the Bush Justice Department had at least 20 phone contacts concerning Ruby Ridge in the 24 hours before Vicki Weaver was shot, which included two phone calls with Barr. Law enforcement agents shot and killed Weaver's 14-year-old son, an FBI sharpshooter Lon Horiuchi would later blow his wife Vicki's head off as she held her infant daughter in her arms. In January 1995, FBI Director Louis Freeh predictably gave slaps on the wrist to FBI officials involved, including his friend Larry Potts, who had supervised the disastrous situation, demonstrating again the bipartisan nature of the corruption, the swamp, if you will. Bill Clinton's Attorney General Janet Reno would later nominate Potts for FBI Deputy Director. Barr told the New York Times that his friend Potts was deliberate and careful, and I developed a great deal of confidence in his judgment. I can't think of enough good things to say about him. Shortly after this, Potts was suspended by the FBI for perjury, although, predictably, no charges were brought against him, and he was permitted to enjoy his lucrative retirement at taxpayer expense. When a jury eventually awarded the surviving Weaver family members a large financial settlement, it cost the Justice Department, read U.S. taxpayers, some $3 million to settle the wrongful death lawsuit. But Barr saw to it that FBI sniper Horiuchi was not punished, pleading with the court that it could severely undermine, if not cripple, the ability of future attorneys general to rely on such specialized units in moments of crisis such as hostage taking and terrorist acts. Upholding the verdict against the government's appeal, federal judge Alex Kaczynski wrote, "A group of FBI agents formulated rules of engagement that permitted their colleagues to hide in the bushes and gun down men who posed no immediate threat. Such wartime rules are patently unconstitutional for a police action." Barr had, in fact, worked diligently, pro bono, in an effort to shield Horiuchi, the most obvious individual who should have been criminally prosecuted, from legal punishment. These efforts included organizing letters on his behalf and framing arguments for both the trial and the appeals process. Given his lengthy history of serving the deep state, it should come as little surprise that Barr has opted not to follow the Justice Department Inspector General's, IG, recommendation to prosecute former FBI Director James Comey. The IG report charged, "We conclude that Comey's infamous memos were official FBI records, rather than Comey's personal documents." Accordingly, after his removal as FBI Director, Comey violated applicable policies in his employment agreement by releasing official FBI information and records to third parties without authorization, and by failing to immediately alert the FBI about his disclosures. The Justice Department has now authorized prosecutors to seek an indictment against former FBI Acting Director Andrew McCabe for lying to investigators. McCabe's appeal was denied by Deputy Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen. If Barr actually follows through with this prosecution, it will be the first time he has gone against the deep state in his long career. New study, WTC7 Didn't Collapse from Fire, by Mark Anderson. The vastly improbable official story of what happened in Lower Manhattan on September 11, 2001 didn't fall as fast as some may have hoped, but it has nevertheless collapsed, with apparent finality, in the light of a four-year University of Alaska Fairbanks study which found that uncontrolled fires did not bring down the World Trade Center's Building 7, contrary to the U.S. government's contention that fires alone brought down the structure. Using blueprints of the construction of the Salomon Brothers Building, as Building 7 was formally named, university engineers, according to their report, developed sophisticated computer models of the 47-story building, the collapse of which happened about 7 hours after the WTC's Twin Towers collapsed on the morning of that grim Tuesday. "The principal conclusion of our study is that fire did not cause the collapse of WTC 7 on 9/11, contrary to the conclusions of NIST and private engineering firms that studied the collapse." A draft report on the findings notes, "NIST is the federal government's National Institute of Standards and Technology. The agency has tried to maintain, in the face of growing skepticism that burning materials from the neighboring Twin Towers, within the 16-acre WTC complex, hit WTC Building 7 and set it ablaze, and that the building eventually succumbed to intense internal fires and crumbled to the ground." Architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, AE 911 Truth, which funded the University of Alaska Fairbanks research, said in a statement in the immediate wake of the study's findings that it's calling for a sustained effort by 8911 Truth and our supporters to get Congress to acknowledge the University of Alaska Fairbanks WTC 7 report and determine that NIST, failed in its congressional mandate to explain the likely technical cause of WTC-7's freefall collapse on 9/11. The study, which examined how the building's design would have responded to fires at the 13th floor, where most of the fires reportedly occurred, also took into account the official NIST collapse scenario, and then ran multiple computer simulations destroying various structural points in order to identify which failures would have had to occur for the destruction of the building to happen as it did. The models show that the only way to replicate the observed collapse is to simulate the failure of every column at nearly the same time. An informational video on the study by AE911 Truth noted, the study summarizes, "It is our conclusion that the collapse of WTC-7 was a global failure involving the near simultaneous failure of all columns in the building and not a progressive collapse involving the sequential failure of columns throughout the building." Many 9/11 researchers are well aware of the university's study and its conclusions, and it has bolstered their resolve to continue pushing for a new investigation into the events of September 11, 2001. They want to know what did cause the mysterious collapse of Building 7 if it was not fire, and what could have caused the failure of every column at nearly the exact same time, a scenario reminiscent of a controlled demolition using explosives. Flynn exonerated, has memo cleared Trump advisor Michael Flynn? By Donald Jeffries Teehee, attorney for beleaguered general, Michael Flynn claims to have uncovered a memo that is exculpatory toward his client. In light of this, Flynn's lawyer, Sidney Powell, will ask U.S. District Judge Emmett Sullivan to delay a conference scheduled to discuss Flynn's potential cooperation with prosecutors. In a recent hearing, Powell noted that the Department of Justice had sat on the texts between FBI employees Lisa Page and Peter Strzok for months, violating the court's discovery order. There is far more at stake here than sentencing. As new counsel, we have an ethical obligation to review everything that has happened in the case or not happened, as the case may be, and that is why we filed the motion to compel production of Brady material. There have been stunning failures to produce Brady in this case, going back as far as July 2017, when the government had the Page Strzok text messages sufficient to cause the removal of Mr. Strzok and Ms. Page, yet not a single Page Strzok text message was produced to the defense. The Brady referred to as a pretrial discovery rule that requires the prosecution to turn over all evidence that may prove defendants are innocent to the defendants and their lawyers in criminal cases. Other documents that the Department of Justice are still withholding include a Russian agent exoneration memo from January 30, 2017 and a February 8, 2017 memo clearing Flynn of Logan Act allegations. Insinuated by former FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe, Powell went on to charge egregious government misconduct and long-time suppression of crucial Brady material that should have been provided to the defense before there ever was a plea. Journalist Sarah Carter broke the story about the bombshell January 30, 2017 memo that conclusively destroys all the inferences that Flynn was guilty of collusion with Russia. Judge Sullivan is obviously taking the Brady issues very seriously and clearly told the prosecutors that his Brady order stands regardless of the plea agreement or the plea, Powell told Carter. If the prosecutors here were seeking justice instead of a conviction, General Flynn would not have been prosecuted. They have been hiding evidence that he was exonerated in early 2017. Judicial Watch President Tom Fitton has urged President Donald Trump to pardon Flynn. Other than to wish him good luck before the sentencing process, Trump hasn't indicated any willingness to do this. In May of this year, Trump unleashed a self-serving tweet, declaring, "It now seems General Flynn was under investigation long before was common knowledge. It would have been impossible for me to know this, but if that was the case, and with me being one of two people who would become president, why was I not told so that I could make a change?" In March 2017, the National Enquirer, run by longtime Trump friend David Pecker, alleged that Flynn was a Russian spy. The story, in fact, quoted top White House officials who claimed that Flynn was, in essence, the Russian spy in Trump's midst. One of those officials may well have been Vice President Mike Pence, who was said to be working behind the scenes to make Flynn the fall guy. In June 2017, Trump's White House special counsel Ty Cobb sent an email to White House social media director Dan Scavino, in which he wrote, "I have great confidence there is nothing there implicating the president or the White House. Manafort and Flynn have issues separate and apart from the White House that will cause the investigation to linger, but I'm hoping we get a clean bill of health soon. The entire Russian collusion fairy tale has claimed a few victims, despite Mueller's investigation all but acknowledging there was absolutely nothing to it. While Trump appears to be safe, Paul Manafort, Roger Stone, Jerome Corsi, and Flynn may be the hapless scapegoats, unfairly punished over a totally imaginary, politically motivated conspiracy theory. Some have speculated that it's no coincidence that all of those targeted and facing legal repercussions appear to be the few individuals outside the swamp that Trump promised to drain, but quickly filled with nothing but establishment figures. When Flynn was forced from his position of national security advisor after less than a month on the job, he was unceremoniously labeled a conspiracy theorist by the mainstream media. Flynn was particularly taken to task for directing his Twitter followers to alternative news sources and blogs to give conspiracies that sort of endorsement without checking the facts thoroughly is not something you associate with national security," charged George Washington University professor Elizabeth Saunders. Flynn suggested Hillary Clinton was involved in money laundering, sex crimes with children, etc. on Twitter. Instead of conspiracy theorist Flynn, Trump eventually wound up with the likes of warmongers John Bolton and Mike Pompeo, to the delight of neocons everywhere. Attack on U.S. history continues. San Francisco school board votes to censor George Washington murals. By Dr. Kevin Barrett. I am staying in San Francisco's historic Seal Rock Inn, next door to the room formerly occupied by notorious Gonzo journalist Hunter S. Thompson, author of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and other classics. Thompson had drug issues, wrote acerbic socio-political commentary, and was once sued for groping a woman in a hot tub. He may have been suicided due to his interest in alternative theories about the events of September 11, 2001. Like most people, especially famous ones, Thompson had both strengths and weaknesses, virtues and vices. But regardless of how bad some of his vices may have been, there are rumors that his discussion of adrenochrome harvested from the adrenal glands of sacrificed children may not have been entirely fictional. I am not going to demand that the Seal Rock and stop telling people that Thompson did some of his writing here. History is history, whether good, bad, or ugly. We erase it at our peril. Half a mile down the street from the Seal Rock Inn, certain unsavory aspects of American history are being literally covered up. George Washington High School, home of a series of famous murals depicting the father of our country as a slaveholder and Indian killer, has been at the center of a censorship controversy. The murals, painted by a radical leftist emigre named Victor Arnautoff, savagely criticize our founding fathers' treatment of black people and Native Americans. If anyone were going to censor them, it should be conservatives, right? Tellingly, it is not pro-George Washington conservatives who are pushing to censor artworks that ferociously criticize our nation's first president and Revolutionary War hero. Instead, it is liberals and leftists who presumably agree with Arnautoff's anti-Washington views. Why would leftists, who agree with Arnautoff about the sins of the founding fathers, censor his artworks? One reason is that some pro-censorship voices apparently don't understand the murals. According to the Richmond Review, a neighborhood newspaper, those on the advisory committee calling for the destruction of the murals say the depictions in the mural glorify slavery, genocide, colonization, manifest destiny, white supremacy, and oppression. This is just not true. While the intentions of authors and artists can sometimes be debated, what is Mona Lisa smiling about? In other cases, it is very clear what an artist meant in a particular work of art. There is an abundance of historical evidence showing that Arnautoff was a left-wing critic of George Washington, and that the murals in question are clearly a condemnation of Washington's treatment of Native Americans and black slaves. Any other interpretation is either willfully perverse or just plain stupid. Some of the murals' critics don't care about the artist's intentions, or what the real message of the murals might be. They argue that students will suffer negative emotional effects when they see images of Washington mistreating blacks and Indians. That argument might be valid in a kindergarten class, but high school students are old enough to grapple with the facts of history. The whole purpose of education is to help people overcome their emotional biases so they can think critically about contentious issues. Anyone who thinks high school students are a bunch of sensitive little snowflakes who can't handle unpleasant historical facts is a fatuous, patronizing fool who has no business telling a civilized society how to educate its young citizens. The controversy surrounding Arnold Off's George Washington High School murals reveals a bizarre twist in contemporary politics. It is now the liberals who are pro-censorship, while conservatives are increasingly in favor of free speech. It wasn't that way when I was growing up. Every censorship controversy I remember from my misspent youth, I attended high school in the 1970s, featured left-wingers promoting free speech, even when it was vulgar or pornographic. While conservatives often favored banning such filth in the name of taste, decency, and conventional values, the citadel of free speech at that time was the American Civil Liberties Union, which was widely known as a liberal leftist organization. Today, many liberals and leftists are such fanatical censors that they want to ban everything that triggers them, even if it's a message they would celebrate if they took the time to think about it. The widespread censorship of the internet via deplatforming and shadowbanning has overwhelmingly targeted conservatives and libertarians. Few liberals and left-wingers have stood up for the free speech of people they disagree with. Today, history itself, in the form of the left-wing Washington murals, the Robert E. Lee statue in Charlottesville, the Confederate cemetery in Madison, Wisk, and countless other monuments, is under attack. If we erase our memories of the past, both good and bad, we will be ill-prepared for the future. Courts show anti-Christian bias. U.S. justice system increasingly dismisses Americans' right to freedom of religion. By Mark Anderson. A frequent underlying theme in our increasingly anti-Christian society is that freedom from religion is given supremacy over freedom of religion. An offended individual need only dislike the mere sight of a Ten Commandments monument, a memorial cross, or a Christian nativity scene on public land in order to receive preferential treatment when filing a lawsuit. But the rights of Christians who erect these monuments and displays, as well as the citizens who approve of them, are readily dismissed. Yet, while persecution pertaining to such displays has been evident for decades, this extreme bias in more recent years has been wielded against service providers such as bakers, photographers, and florists. The latest example of that bias concerns floral artist Baron L. Stutzman. Attorneys representing the 74-year-old great-grandmother asked the Supreme Court of the United States, SCOTUS, to hear her case after the Washington Supreme Court ruled against her for a second time in June. A petition to that effect was filed on September 11. The U.S. Supreme Court vacated the state high court's previous ruling against Stutzman and ordered it to reconsider her case in light of last year's Masterpiece Caca Shop decision, stated a news release from the petitioners, the Alliance Defending Freedom, ADF, which is the Arizona-based legal organization representing Stutzman. This case in several respects mirrors the widely publicized Masterpiece Caca Shop decision, in which SCOTUS reversed Colorado's decision to punish baker Jack Phillips for adhering to his religious beliefs about marriage by declining to bake a cake for a gay wedding. Much like Phillips, Stutzman has upheld her faith-based belief that marriage is a union of one man and one woman by declining to create a floral arrangement for a same-sex wedding, while being slapped with a lawsuit. What's especially noteworthy is that when Stutzman declined to perform floral services for Robert Ingersoll's wedding, Ingersoll, a longtime customer whom Stutzman considers a friend, didn't even object. In other words, it's the government of Washington State, in league with the notoriously anti-Christian American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, which went after Stutzman, in what appears to be a case of blatant anti-Christian persecution. Stutzman even helpfully referred Ingersoll to several nearby florists. As the ADF's news release explained, the two then discussed his wedding plans. They hugged, and Ingersoll left. He never filed a complaint with the Attorney General's office. The Attorney General chose to pursue Stutzman only because of news reports based on social media posts. As the ADF petition notes, Baranel's compassionate response epitomizes how Americans with differing marriage beliefs can peacefully coexist, but the state brought all its power down on Baranel, seeking to compel her to create art against her conscience. The Attorney General concocted a one-of-a-kind lawsuit, prompting others to threaten and harass her, yet the Attorney General did not investigate, demand assurances, or file suit when a gay coffee shop owner berated and booted a group of Christians from his store based on religious views they expressed on a public street. These First Amendment violations must stop, the ADF's petition states. Absent the Supreme Court's review, government officials will keep dragging reasonable and sincere people of faith like Baranel through the courts, imposing ruinous judgments, and barring them from their professions simply because they hold disfavored views about marriage. Religious people should be free to live out their beliefs about marriage, but states like Washington afford that freedom only to people who support same-sex marriage, while stripping it from Baranel and others like her. The ACLU's involvement, which comes as no surprise, is based on an enduring, harmful misperception. The leftist legal outfit rarely misses a chance to proclaim that even the slightest expression of Christianity outside of a church violates the separation of church and state when, in fact, that phrase, famously referred to by founder Thomas Jefferson in a letter to the Danbury Baptists, simply meant that the U.S. government would not have an official denominational church like the Church of England. It had nothing to do with preventing Christian expression in public venues, such as outlawing school prayer or prohibiting Christian ideals from influencing lawmaking, such as outlawing abortion. All such regulations violate the free exercise thereof clause in the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which, lest we forget, protects religious freedom, not just free speech. Bolton's firing is great news, but will Trump's dismissal of Warhawk advisor equal a change in policy? By Philip Giraldi. After months of rumors, John Bolton has finally been fired from the White House, but the postmortem continues, with the punditry trying to understand exactly what happened and why. The most complete explanation for what occurred came from President Donald Trump himself shortly after the fact. He said, in some impromptu comments, that his national security advisor had made some very big mistakes when he talked about a Libyan model for Kim Jong-un. That was not a good statement to make. You just take a look at what happened with Gaddafi. That was not a good statement to make, and it set us back. Trump has a point in that Bolton was clearly suggesting that North Korea get rid of its nuclear weapons in exchange for economic benefits, but it was the wrong example to pick. As Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi gave up his weapons and was then ousted and brutally killed in a rebel uprising supported by Washington, the Bolton analogy, which may have been deliberate, made impossible any agreement between Kim and Trump. Kim received the message loud and clear that he might suffer the same fate. More recently, Bolton might have been behind media leaks that scuttled Trump's plan to meet with Taliban representatives and that also undercut a presidential suggestion that he might meet with Iranian President Hassan Rouhani. Trump summed up his disagreements with Bolton by saying that the national security advisor wasn't getting along with other administration officials, adding, frankly, he wanted to do things, not necessarily tougher than me. John's known as a tough guy. He's so tough he got us into Iraq. That's tough. But he's somebody that I actually had a very good relationship with, but he wasn't getting along with people in the administration who I consider very important. And, you know, John wasn't in line with what we were doing, and actually, in some cases he thought it was too tough, what we were doing. Mr. Tough guy. Trump's final comment on Bolton was that I'm sure he'll do whatever he can do to spin it his way. A throwaway line that can well set the stage for what comes next. Bolton has many supporters among hardliners in the GOP and the media and will no doubt be inclined to respond to the president in kind. But once the back and forth starts, many other factors and relationships will come into play. For example, Bolton is rightly regarded as an Uber hawk, but that is at least somewhat attributable to who has been paying him. That would be casino magnate and Israeli duo national Sheldon Adelson, who represents a good deal of the money behind the anti-Iran movement, of which Bolton is a key player. Many believe that Bolton was appointed National Security Advisor by Trump in response to pressure coming from Adelson, and one might reasonably argue that he was rewarded for his constant calls to bomb Iran. Bolton is a regular participant at terrorist group Mojahideen-e-Khalq, MEK, rallies and has been calling for an attack on Iran since the George W. Bush administration, when he served as recess-appointed U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. The desirability of war with Iran, which does not threaten the United States, is an Israeli concoction that has been picked up by neoconservatives like Bolton, and the foundations that have supported the effort are largely funded by Adelson and other Zionist oligarchs. The problem for Bolton if he chooses to become virulently anti-Trump is that Adelson is also both bankrolling the GOP and providing advice to the president in weekly phone calls. Indeed, one should assume that the firing of Bolton was first cleared by the president with Adelson, and the plot gets even thicker from there. Adelson is currently at odds with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu over his corruption and other issues, but he wanted Bibi to get re-elected because of an electoral campaign pledge to annex all Israeli settlements on the West Bank, ending forever any possibility of a Palestinian state. Netanyahu told Israeli voters that only he can guarantee total support from the American president. Trump in turn was apparently prepared to recognize the annexation to help Netanyahu in exchange for a commitment that the Israeli prime minister would help him electorally in 2020. Adelson supports Trump, supported Netanyahu, supports Bolton, and passionately desires an end to any talk about Palestinian statehood. That would suggest that Bolton will somewhat cool his jets, at least until the Israeli election is verified, and he may even decide to forego a harsh response if he wants to stay on the good side of Adelson. But his neocon friends and their related liberal interventionists both on talk shows and in the media will certainly go after Trump with fire and fury over the dismissal of the outstanding patriot Bolton. An alternative view is that Trump got rid of Bolton for all the right reasons, namely that as president he is disinclined to start any new wars and seeks negotiated solutions to existing conflicts, both of which concepts were no doubt regarded as anathema by the National Security Advisor. Unfortunately, that argument runs into problems where rhetoric and deeds disconnect if one considers actual actions undertaken by the president without Bolton's prodding. First of all, Trump has been overly deferential towards the bona fides of the former military officers and hardliners he has included among his cabinet appointments. He appointed Bolton, though admittedly under orders from Adelson, and also Mike Pompeo first as CIA director and then as Secretary of State. There is no one around who outdoes Pompeo when it comes to avoiding diplomacy and negotiations while also threatening dire consequences for America's enemies. Pompeo will remain in the cabinet, and there was even some talk that he might take over the National Security Advisor duties on top of his responsibilities at state. Trump instead appointed Robert O'Brien, far from fulfilling campaign promises to end the wars he inherited. Trump has continued and even escalated those conflicts. He has withdrawn from agreements with Russia and Iran that enhanced U.S. national security. Drone strikes under Trump have increased dramatically and have exceeded the number occurring during both of Obama's terms, while new rules of engagement have led to a major increase in civilian casualties from U.S. bombing directed against ISIS and the Taliban. Trump supports the Saudi Arabian genocide against Yemen, and the president has demonstrated that he is willing to go to war. He has twice illegally attacked Syria based on phony intelligence, and even when he decides at the last minute not to use force, as he did earlier this year with Iran, there is no serious evidence that he is truly seeking dialogue. He is waging maximum pressure economic warfare against both Iran and Venezuela, in both of which countries he has called for regime change. He has threatened Russia over Crimea and Ukraine. Transparent regime change policies coupled with willy-nilly imposing of sanctions are destructive, hostile steps that kill people in the targeted countries and make enemies where none previously existed. So, does the firing of Bolton mean that there will be a change of direction in U.S. foreign policy? Maybe a course correction, but much more than that is unlikely. Trump will be in full 2020 campaign mode and will be reluctant to step into any new quagmires, but the basic belligerency of the administration is likely to continue. We will know more when we see the new National Security Advisor in action. Thank goodness it was not temporary replacement Charles Copperman, a devout friend and ally of Bolton. One must assume that the problems with Bolton were based on the fact that he was not a team player and possibly even a leaker, rather than policy-based. Unfortunately, O'Brien appears to be another swamp creature, a longtime government insider who has worked for both Republicans and Democrats for many years. Still, he could not be worse than Bolton. Either way, it is good to see Bolton gone. Anytime a neocon and Israel Firster is removed from the board, it is good for the United States. The truth about America's gulags. How did the American people become the most incarcerated in the world? By St. Patrick. American jails and prisons house more inmates than were held inside Joseph Stalin's notorious gulag system at the height of its use. Whether you look at it in total population, America surpassed the gulags in 2012, and the total number of incarcerated still exceeds Stalin's worst days, or per capita, as of January 1, 2008. 1 out of 100 American adults were in prison or jail, compared to 0.8 out of 100 Russian adults in Stalin's gulags. America continues to be the world's leader in the caging of human beings as an acceptable and popular form of punishment. There has been a very recent push for prison reform, especially by Midwestern Republicans in states like Ohio. Prison reform is one issue on which the far right has bonded with the far left, both led by the libertarians, who have long argued for massive reform and less incarceration. There is a debate over just who is locked up, and is a debate with no winner or loser, depending on which set of demographics are used. Are most inmates locked up for nonviolent drug offenses, or people stopped with a dime bag, as Rep. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, DNY, called them? The answer is both no and yes. In a recent Washington Post column, John Piaf, a law professor at Fordham University, pointed out that in state prisons, 55% are behind bars for violent crimes compared to 15% being caged for drug offenses. While true, state prisoners make up two-thirds of the incarcerated in America, one-third of those locked up today are in city and county facilities, jails as opposed to prisons, in the corrections vernacular. In most states, a sentence of under 366 days will be served entirely in a city or county jail, while a sentence over 365 days will be served in a state or federal prison. Of those serving time in jails, a vast majority are serving time for drug offenses. In an expose for Time magazine called Incarceration Nation, CNN's Fareed Zakaria explained that of the 6 million Americans incarcerated in jails and prisons combined, over half are serving time for drug offenses, and over 80% of those were convicted of mere possession. Yet, the drug problem in small-town America continues to throttle what were once sleepy, quiet towns. Has the war on drugs, 48 years after the phrase was popularized by President Richard Nixon, been effective against the illegal drug industry, or has it simply created a system of corrections larger and more destructive than it has ever been? Part of the problem with incarceration has been that it is a popular political issue. From both sides of the political aisle, the politics of fear are effective, especially in the South in states like Florida and Arizona, where the elderly are a vital part of the population, and rates of incarceration are highest among U.S. states. Increased imprisonment is offered by politicians as a solution to fear, real and politically contrived. Coinciding with the rise in incarceration has been the rise of the prison abolition movement, which seeks to end most systems of incarceration. The abolition movement does not seek to just unlock the cages and let everyone go free. Rather, it aggressively continues to push for other alternatives as the first steps to confronting destructive behavior, rather than jails and prisons being a first step of the corrections process, and in many cases the only step. They believe that there can be more family-oriented and community-involved efforts to resolve the underlying issues that push many to offend. Multiple factors, such as mandatory sentencing, perpetuate the level of growth in incarceration. There are also many structural problems in our justice system. There is an exorbitant amount of legislation that overconstricts American behavior, and there is an acceptance, due to centuries of history, that incarceration is in some immediate way a necessity. There is, of course, no one right answer, not right now, but this is something that never changes unless Americans first acknowledge that a problem exists. Then again, all forms of crime, including violence, are at historic lows. Criminal justice experts, however, are not sure whether this is the result of locking up the bad guys or because the U.S. has grown so wealthy that even the poor, which make up most of the criminals in society, live reasonably comfortable lives today and have a lot to lose should they choose a life of crime. As of May 2018, 655 of every 100,000 Americans were behind bars. The second most prosecutorial country is Turkey, which has 287 out of 100,000 of its citizens serving time. To compare similar countries, Canadian numbers are 114 out of 100,000 and Great Britain stands at 141 out of 100,000. America has close to 5% of the world's population and almost 25% of the world's prisoners. The next time we think that a country like China or Russia or Thailand is a place where the smallest infraction will lead you to lifelong imprisonment, we should take note that the truest culprit is the one standing in the geopolitical mirror. Israel caught spying on Trump, president denies leaked report, takes no action to punish White House eavesdroppers. By John Friend in an explosive report published in early September, the D.C. based political journal Politico cited three former senior U.S. officials who all confirmed that Israel was more than likely behind the stationing of sophisticated cell phone surveillance devices around the nation's capital, an espionage operation designed to surveil and monitor President Donald Trump and his closest advisors and confidants. The devices, commonly known as stingrays in intelligence circles, mimic cell towers and trick cell phones in the area into giving up their sensitive data, including their location and other identifying information. The devices are also known to be able to capture a cell phone's data use, call contents, and other important information key to espionage operations. It was unclear how successful the operation was. Politico's report came following an extensive investigation conducted over the course of the past 2 years by top federal officials and agencies, including the Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, and the Secret Service, into foreign espionage operations carried out against the U.S. federal government, a key concern for national security and intelligence officials. It was pretty clear that the Israelis were responsible, an unnamed former senior U.S. intelligence official told Politico. Israeli officials, including Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, denied the reports, insisting that Israel would never spy on the U.S., describing the report as a blatant lie. The Prime Minister's office released a statement describing a long-standing commitment and directive from the Israeli government not to engage in any intelligence operations in the U.S. This directive is strictly enforced without exception. The statement continued, Israeli Foreign Minister Israel Katz denied the reports as well, and issued a statement instead focusing on the cooperation the Israeli government shares with the U.S. The U.S. and Israel share a lot of intelligence information and work together to prevent threats and strengthen the security of both countries, Katz stated. Other former Israeli officials, including Imis Yadlin, the former head of Israeli military intelligence, denied and denounced the report, describing such allegations as fake news spiced with anti-Semitism. U.S. officials likewise were quick to deny the report, with an unnamed senior U.S. official telling the Los Angeles Times that the report is completely and absolutely false. President Donald Trump himself denied and downplayed the report, telling reporters recently that he doesn't think the Israelis are spying on us. I really would find that hard to believe, the president stated. My relationship with Israel has been great. Israel has a long, well-documented history of spying on the U.S., including monitoring private conversations, obtaining sensitive and classified information relating to technological and industrial advancements, and stealing military secrets. Additionally, allegations of Israeli-sponsored blackmail operations against key U.S. politicians and officials have long proliferated in the nation's capital and around the country. with the recent scandal involving Jeffrey Epstein being one prime example. And, of course, there was the revelation of a massive Israeli spy ring operating in and around sensitive U.S. targets before September 11, 2001, as confirmed by the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, DEA, in its special draft report on the subject, reproduced by American Free Press. This report was suppressed by then Attorney General John Ashcroft and officially dismissed as an urban myth, but the facts in this DEA report belie the Department of Justice and FBI joint cover up of Israeli spying and possible foreknowledge of 9/11, see above to get a copy of this report. Given the Trump administration's fierce loyalty to Israel, no action was taken following the revelation by federal investigators that the Mideast state was likely behind the deployment of the espionage devices in the nation's capital. One former U.S. official told Politico that they were not aware of any accountability at all. The reaction was very different than it would have been in the last administration, the official stated, describing how unconcerned the Trump administration was with the findings of federal investigators. With the current administration, there are a different set of calculations in regard to addressing this. The former federal official cited by Politico went on to describe the nature of Israeli espionage operations, noting that the Israelis are pretty aggressive when it comes to intelligence gathering. They're all about protecting the security of the Israeli state, and they do whatever they feel they have to achieve that objective. He added, despite the U.S.'s unwavering political and diplomatic support for Israel and the granting of billions of dollars annually in financial assistance and other forms of aid, America's greatest ally continues to engage in treachery, subversion, and blatant criminality in the heart of the U.S. Capitol with impunity. Will Bibi be indicted? Politician accused of corruption, instigating war, by Richard Walker with over 97% of the vote counted. The centrist Blue and White Party, which would like to open up a dialogue with Palestinians, looks to have won the largest number of seats in the Knesset, 32 out of a total of 120. Benjamin Bibi Netanyahu's right-wing Likud came in a close second, with 31 seats. This is good news, as during his tenure as prime minister, Bibi the bully has deliberately set Israel on course for widespread war across the entire Mideast region. Netanyahu has held on to the post of prime minister for a decade. In the last few years, he has pushed for another war with Hezbollah in Lebanon to settle the score for Israel's poor performance in its war against Hezbollah in 2006. Back then, Israel underestimated the Lebanese militia and lost frontline troops and many tanks. Netanyahu has also done everything possible to engage Iran in a war and to attack targets in Lebanon and Syria, hoping for a backlash from Hezbollah, Iran, or the Syrian government led by Bashar al-Assad. To that end, Israel has carried out hundreds of bombings in Syria and Lebanon with a new tactic of using armed drone swarms directed at Hezbollah targets in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. In the lead-up to this hotly contested election, it should come as no surprise that Netanyahu's strategy was to start a conflict or promise one in the hope of salvaging his political career. Last April he won the popular vote, but his Likud party was unable to build a large enough coalition in parliament to form a government. Knowing this, he has been busy using his familiar bully pulpit, promising to deal harshly with Iran and Hezbollah. Lately, he angered the United Nations and international leaders by promising that if re-elected he would annex vast swaths of the Jordan Valley that Palestinians had hoped would form part of their new state. Behind all this bluster lies a man looking at possible jail time if, as appears likely, he faces charges for the criminal abuse of his position once he is out of power. His only hope to stay out of jail is to be re-elected, and he has been willing to go to any lengths to make that happen. Even if Netanyahu loses power, there is strong evidence that he has already succeeded in moving his country so far to the extreme right that he has induced chaos in the political structure of Israel, increasing its potential for growing militarism. But that is not the whole story. While he has been busy plotting with erratic Saudi leader Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to sow chaos in Iraq, Syria, Iran, Yemen, Lebanon, and Syria, he has also been busy using his intelligence service, the Mossad, to buck the grounds of the White House. See the accompanying story on pages 18-19 for more on the latest charges of Israeli spying, ed. like other Israeli leaders before him, who sanctioned the theft of America's nuclear secrets, he will play the anti-Semitic card, that takes the form of Israeli leaders claiming Israel is America's best friend and that one does not target one's best friend and that any claims to the contrary are anti-Jewish propaganda, that, of course, has been proven to be a lie time after time. The Israeli mantra has always been Israel first. One could list the numerous Israeli spies who have stolen American secrets, from publishing tycoon Robert Maxwell to mega spy Jonathan Pollard. As the latest spying revelations were being made public, Netanyahu's own account on Facebook was taken offline for 24 hours because of hateful comments he made about Arabs. It was later reinstated after he alleged that the post had been made by a staffer and not him. The White House has so far denied the spying allegation, though the fact that Netanyahu authorized such an operation will surely lead to some disturbing questions on Capitol Hill. It raises the prospect that Israel does not trust the Trump presidency. It could well be that Trump's willingness to consider a summit with Iran's leaders has so unnerved the Israeli establishment that they have been prepared to risk the president's ire by bugging his home. If Mossad is willing to take such a risk, what other operations have been targeted at the president's in his inner circle is a question that is now surely being asked within U.S. intelligence circles. Has the Mossad recorded Trump's personal phone calls in an attempt to gather information to use against him? And if Israel is so concerned about a summit that could lead to a new nuclear deal with Iran, would Netanyahu, if re-elected, or his successor resort to starting a war in Lebanon to draw in Iran and scupper Trump's diplomatic overtures in parts of the region? Netanyahu may be able to cling to power if he can successfully negotiate a compromise with other religious and right-wing parties, but that may be short-lived as prosecutors continue to close in with charges that he and his wife have repeatedly taken bribes while in positions of power over the course of the past few years. Either way, it appears Bibi the Bully's time is short. The Trayvon Martin hoax film, book show how facts twisted to bolster racist narrative. By Donald Jeffries. The death of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin on February 26, 2012 unleashed a fury of distorted coverage by the mainstream media, and triggered the establishment left, paving the way for groups like Black Lives Matter and Antifa. Author and filmmaker Joel Gilbert has documented it all in his new book and film, The Trayvon Hoax, Unmasking the Witness Fraud That Divided America, showing that most of the story publicized by the mainstream media was just plain wrong. First off, Gilbert found that the prosecution's star witness against George Zimmerman, the memorable Rachel Jean Chell, was actually not the girl who was on the phone with Martin just before he was shot. Gilbert was able to identify 16-year-old Diamond Eugene as the individual whose recorded conversation with attorney Benjamin Crump inflamed public passions, provoked President Barack Obama himself into the fray, and resulted in Zimmerman's arrest. Utilizing Diamond's extensive social media postings, as well as unredacted court documents, Gilbert was able to dissect Martin's troubled teenage life. The half-Hispanic George Zimmerman was demonized beyond all reason by a compliant media anxious to categorize him as a white racist and the predictable virtue signaling of crass politicians. Unpublicized was the fact that Zimmerman was a civil rights activist and supporter of Barack Obama. NBC even went to the despicable lengths of editing an audio tape to make it appear as if Zimmerman had sounded racist, when the unedited tape told an entirely different story. Zimmerman filed a lawsuit against NBC, which was laughably dismissed by a Florida circuit judge, who absurdly claimed the network had not acted maliciously in doctoring a tape. In the unedited exchange on the tape with a 911 dispatcher, Zimmerman states, "This guy looks like he's up to no good, or he's on drugs or something. It's raining, and he's just walking around, looking about." The dispatcher asked for a description. "Okay, and this guy, is he black, white or Hispanic?" Zimmerman replies, "He looks black." In NBC News's dishonest and creatively edited version of the conversation, Zimmerman says, "This guy looks like he's up to no good. He looks black." NBC threw two low-level employees under the bus and fired them, and issued an apology. NBC News spokeswoman Ali Zelenko responded to the inexplicable action by the judge by stating that the network was gratified by the court's dismissal of this lawsuit, which we have always believed to be without merit. Zimmerman and his family reportedly experienced numerous threats, some of them public, as the controversy over the former volunteer neighborhood watchman's shooting death of Martin, as well as Florida Stand Your Ground gun law, split the country much as the O.J. Simpson case had 20 years earlier. Roseanne Barr famously tweeted the address of Zimmerman's parents, in what seemed an overt effort to incite violence against them. While Ms. Barr deleted her tweet, she refused to back down, tweeting again that it was good to let people know that no one can hide anymore. If Zimmerman isn't arrested, I'll RT, retweet or repost his address again, even more irresponsibly. Director Spike Lee had earlier tweeted what he believed was the address of Zimmerman's parents, but was in fact the home of an unrelated elderly couple. After a firestorm of criticism resulted, Lee eventually settled with the couple to avoid a lawsuit. MSNBC, in predictable fashion, attempted to excuse Lee's malicious act as a Twitter error. President Obama memorably stated, "If I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon." Obama's comments were all the more remarkable in that they came after Zimmerman had been found not guilty, and included incendiary references to blacks, including himself, being looked upon with fear by everyone from white women in elevators to white store employees tracking their every move. Obama didn't comment on the verdict and, like everyone else, ignored Martin's litany of petty but persistent offenses and the fact his mother had kicked him out of her house for his behavior. In a video filmed by his lawyer, Zimmerman objected mightily to the way he was portrayed in the media. "My last name carrying a Caucasian German connotation definitely helped them portray me as a racist white man, when in reality I am, you know, my mother's Peruvian, my father is American, and I was raised by my mother and my grandmother, both fully Hispanic." He called President Obama's statement clearly a dereliction of duty, pitting Americans against each other solely based on race. "Because of the lack of civil libertarians left in present-day America, few objected to the president injecting himself into a legal case in such a partisan manner." A jury acquitted Zimmerman of second-degree murder and manslaughter charges in July 2013, but he remains a guilty racist in the eyes of many Americans. The dishonest narrative fueled by our state-controlled media exacerbated the already deep cultural divide in this country. "Dark Age Disease Is Back," by Dave Gahery. Signs of the collapse of our nation are all around us, from the crumbling infrastructure, to the drug-infested ghettos in once magnificent cities, to ever-expanding homeless camps taking over parks and sidewalks. Now, another sign of America's breakdown is apparent. European diseases not seen since the 14th century are appearing on our shores. An opinion piece in The Hill by Dr. Mark Siegel. "Is a Dark Ages disease the new American plague threat?" details the brewing disaster. Although typhus, a disease carried by fleas that feed on rats, which in turn feed on the garbage and sewage, is already present in homeless encampments across the country, Siegel believes that homeless areas are at risk for the re-emergence of another deadly ancient disease, leprosy. Leprosy is a long-term bacterial infection that can lead to damage to eyes, nerves, respiratory tract, and skin. Although over two-thirds of the more than 200,000 new cases of leprosy reported in the world each year are in India, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports that between 100 and 200 new cases of leprosy are reported annually in the U.S. Siegel cites a just-released study that found that 187 leprosy patients treated at the same clinic from 1973 to 2018 were mostly Mexicans. The disease is also known to Central and South Americans, popping up more than 20,000 times a year, Siegel writes. "There is certainly the possibility of sporadic cases of leprosy continuing to be brought across our southern border undetected." Siegel goes on to say that it seems only a matter of time before leprosy could take hold among the homeless population in an area such as Los Angeles County, with close to 60,000 homeless people and 75% of those lacking even temporary shelter or adequate hygiene and medical treatment. All of those factors make a perfect cauldron for a contagious disease that is transmitted by nasal droplets and respiratory secretions with close repeated contact. To look into this matter further, American Free Press conducted an exclusive interview with Tucson, Arizona-based Dr. Jane Orient, the executive director of the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, founded in 1943 to fight for private medicine. Orient, in practice since 1974, was coincidentally in Los Angeles at the time of this interview on September 17. AFP asked if we should be worried about Siegel's article. "I think that we should," she began, "although I think maybe leprosy is one of the lesser worries. I think tuberculosis, TB, is a much greater worry, because leprosy is reputedly not all that contagious and there's an antibiotic treatment for it. TB, another bacterial infection spread through the air by coughing, sneezing, speaking, and spitting, typically affects the lungs, and if left untreated will kill around 50% of those affected. So, it's not just the zero sanitation homeless camps Orient is worried about. We're allowing into this country now thousands, maybe millions, of people who have not been screened," she explained, "who are going to locations that are unknown. Of the ones that we know about, maybe 20% of them in some places have latency to TB. They are not contagious right now, but this could break down at any time when their resistance is lowered, and they could be coughing up TB germs on the bus, in the school, in the church, wherever they are. Everybody should be worried about this," she explained, "because these people are being sent across the U.S. and what we really need is a way of following these people and doing periodic checks." Orient feels this issue has been politicized. "There is a lot of fear about being accused of being politically incorrect," she said. "Even a physician who talks about this can be criticized, or ignored, or subject to worse things. I have heard that some people who work in these border areas are even being forbidden to talk about the diseases that they were seeing, under pain of losing their job. Public health affects everybody," she warned, "and we're not doing anybody a favor by closing our eyes to devastating diseases that could break out in the community. We really don't have the knowledge to treat these things. Many of them are virtually untreatable, and we're just really turning a blind eye to this. DMVs make millions selling your data, but data abuse by private investigation firms may be the most concerning." By Dave Gallery, as if the junk mail and telemarketing robocalls weren't enough to ruin our days, add legal intrusions by a government agency to do the same, or worse. It hasn't been widely reported, but departments of motor vehicles, DMVs, in every state in the union, are minting money, legally, by selling your personal data to a variety of entities, like insurance companies, consumer credit reporting agencies, courts and attorneys, companies involved in the bulk distribution of surveys, marketing materials, companies involved in solicitations for statistical reports and other research, private toll transportation facilities, truck and tow, truck companies, and licensed private investigation agencies. The sale of private information to any of the above is disturbing, but it's personal information in the hands of private investigators, PIs, that has many worried. "This is all made possible thanks to a federal law known as the Driver's Privacy Protection Act of 1994, DPPA, which governs the personal information gathered by state DMVs. DPPA had its origins, ironically, in the murder of a Hollywood starlet. Rebecca Schaefer was murdered by a deranged fan, Robert John Bardo, who had stalked her for 3 years. Bardo studied the actions of another nutcase, who had stalked and stabbed another actress in 1982, and learned that a private investigator was used to obtain the actress's address. Bardo did the same. He paid a private eye firm in his hometown of Tucson to get Schaefer's home address from California's DMV, then traveled to the Golden State and shot her at point-blank range when she answered the door, expecting a script to be delivered for an audition for the film The Godfather Part II. Now, a law meant to protect Americans from having their personal information released to those with less than honorable reasons for wanting it may be putting countless Americans in danger, as unscrupulous characters use this law for illegal means. Researchers for a recent report released on September 6 by news and commentary website Vice under the headline DMVs are selling your data to private investigators had obtained hundreds of pages of documents from DMVs through public records requests that lay out the practice. It paints a scary picture of just how much information is being swapped for cash, and how prevalent it is. One of the seedy practices Vice uncovered is that many of the private investigators that DMVs have sold data to explicitly advertise that they will surveil spouses to see if they are cheating. All pies aren't like good guy Joe Mannix, played by actor Mike Connors, in the TV detective series Mannix, that ran from 1967 to 1975 on CBS. Although just five states have no license requirements for private investigators, Alaska, Idaho, Mississippi, South Dakota, and Wyoming, the remaining 45 states and D.C. do have specific licensing requirements, with most offering low barriers to entry, be at least 21, possess a high school diploma or equivalent, and have U.S. citizenship or residency. Vice uncovered that Delaware's DMV has data sharing agreements with at least 12 pie firms. New Jersey's DMV has sold its residence data to at least 16 pie firms. Virginia's DMV sold its citizens' data to 109 pie firms, and Wisconsin's DMV coughed up its residence info to around 24 such firms. There have been many instances of abuse of personal information as well. Several DMVs admitted to Vice that access to such data has been abused in the past, likely by customers using the data in a way that they were not authorized to do so. North Carolina's DMV said as much in an email. Yes, it has been done before, wrote NC's communications manager when asked if the DMV has cut off access to data buyers after abuse. The same goes for the DMVs of Florida, Indiana, NJ, and Virginia. They all admitted they've revoked access or terminated contracts because of data abuse. And since Texas has no licensing requirements to get into the business of repossessing vehicles, convicted felons can and do access professional databases. Perhaps not surprisingly, the data sharing is primarily being done for one reason: the almighty dollar. This is a revenue-generating contract, the Indiana DMV boasted in a document Vice obtained, and the numbers speak for themselves. Rhode Island's DMV took in $384,000 from selling personal data between 2015 and 2019. Wisconsin's DMV received $17,140,914 just in 2018, and Florida's DMV chalked up $77 million in 2017 alone. Time to hang up the black robe. Despite multiple major health woes, Ruth Bader Ginsburg won't retire, by St. Patrick T. He continued failing health of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has created what magazine Vanity Fair called an RBG death watch within the Trump administration. While the administration is cautiously avoiding being portrayed as morbid or opportunistic, feelers have been sent out to conservative activists to test the waters for potential Supreme Court nominees. Ginsburg, 86, has served on the Supreme Court since her appointment by President Bill Clinton in 1993. Of the current court, only Justice Clarence Thomas has served longer than Ginsburg. Americans now used to contentious confirmation hearings may forget that Ginsburg was approved by a 96-3 vote of the Senate. That is the largest margin of approval on this current court, seconded only by Clinton's other nominee, Stephen Breyer, who was confirmed 87-9. Ginsburg's confirmation hearings affected the way nominees now answer questions. She refused to answer certain specific questions from senators, circumventing getting painted into an ideological corner and refusing to pass political litmus tests. This refusal, invoked also by Justice John Roberts, is now called the Ginsburg precedent. Ginsburg, however, has been in failing health from the earliest years of her tenure. In 1999, she was diagnosed with colon cancer. In 2009, she was diagnosed again with cancer, this time an early-stage tumor in her pancreas. In the last decade, she has experienced hospitalization due to iron deficiency. She had a stent placed in her right coronary artery, she fractured three ribs in a fall, and she's undergone a left lung lobectomy to remove even more cancerous nodules. Last month, Ginsburg completed multiple sessions of focused radiology to destroy a tumor found, again, in her pancreas. The first calls for Ginsburg to retire came, surprisingly, from Democrats during the Obama administration. Progressive legal activists urged her to retire while Obama was in office and the Democrats firmly controlled the Senate so that a younger, like-minded justice could be inserted in her place. Ginsburg refused. In 2016, Ginsburg broke ranks with court tradition and violated the non-binding code of conduct for United States justices by speaking out publicly about an ongoing presidential campaign. She told the New York Times, "I can't imagine what this place would be. I can't imagine what the country would be with Donald Trump as our president." She then joked that if Trump won, it would be time to relocate to New Zealand. Trump responded in a typically forceful tweet, "Justice Ginsburg of the U.S. Supreme Court has embarrassed all by making very dumb political statements about me. Her mind is shot. Resign." The next day, he tweeted, "Is Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg going to apologize to me for her misconduct? Big mistake by an incompetent judge. Trump may now have to replace her in what could be his third Supreme Court nomination. This includes Justices Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh, both of whom Ginsburg has publicly described as very decent and very smart." During the 2016 campaign, Trump stated that either he or Hillary Clinton would potentially have to replace up to five Supreme Court justices. News website Axios recently reported on a source who had spoken with Trump about the Supreme Court. "It appears that the president believes that Sonia Sotomayor, 65, appointed by President Barack Obama in 2009, will retire early." The source for the Axios story reported Trump's reasoning as was told to him: "Her health, Trump said, no good, diabetes. Sotomayor has struggled with a lifelong case of type 1 diabetes." Regarding Ginsburg, Trump is reported to have asked, "What does she weigh?" 60 pounds. As it stands now, the makeup of the Supreme Court should dictate that it is more conservative than it has ruled. That comes as no surprise to legal analysts and professional court watchers. In a USA Today opinion piece, Elia Shapiro noted, "There were 67 decisions after argument in the term that ended in June. In those cases, the four justices appointed by Democratic presidents voted the same way 51 times, while the five Republican appointees held tight 37 times. And of the 20 cases where the court split 5-4, only 7 had the expected ideological divide of conservatives over liberals." By the end of the term, each conservative justice had joined the liberals as the deciding vote at least once. This isn't new. This trend traces back at least 10 years. Therefore, any knee-jerk fear-mongering that warns of the impending death of justice as the bench becomes more conservative is highly exaggerated. The Trump administration is looking, it is vetting, and it is wisely taking advice from activists across the country. They are expecting that there will come a time when a decision must be made, a decision that Ginsburg seems determined not to allow. In a recent interview with National Public Radio, Ginsburg said, "I am very much alive. But if 2020 buys Trump 4 more years on Pennsylvania Avenue, everything could change, and the leverage in this judicial war of attrition would reside in the Oval Office." Former DA butchered the Truth book challenges entirety of Charles Manson mass murder narrative by S.T. Patrick after the end of the Tate-LaBianca murder trial in 1971. History really was, as the adage dictates, written by the winners. Charles Manson, Susan Atkins, Leslie Van Houten, and Patricia Krenwinkel had been convicted and sentenced to death. Charles Tex Watson was convicted for the murders in a separate trial after fighting extradition from Texas, where he was apprehended. In 1974, after leaving his position as the Los Angeles County Deputy District Attorney, Vincent Bugliosi, who had successfully prosecuted the Tate-LaBianca case, wrote Helter Skelter with Othorkert Gentry. It has, to date, become the best-selling true crime book in American history, totaling over 7 million copies sold. Until this decade, it had also become the Bible of the Manson story. Bugliosi laid the groundwork for the massive merchandising spree that would come from the Manson case. Movies, including two made from Helter Skelter, documentaries, books, T-shirts, buttons, and the grotesque rise of murderabilia collectors followed the mythological demonization of the store's principles. In the 1970s and 1980s, Manson's music albums became the hottest underground bootlegs. Manson was money, thanks to Bugliosi's portrayal of a Beatles fascination, a determination to start a global race war, and On My Feet hippie beauties pledging loyalty to their huckster philosopher. But with the release of Tom O'Neill's Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, and the secret history of the 60s, we are now looking at Manson, his family, and Bugliosi in a refreshing, more factual way than we have ever before. The prologue to Chaos should not be missed. In it, the author describes a contentious interview conducted at the Bugliosi home. The Manson prosecutor exaggeratedly oscillates through reading long sections of text in defense of his prosecutorial methods, threatening O'Neill in a variety of manners, and being his own hype man, reading laudatory words spoken about him over the last half century. O'Neill was assuredly on Bugliosi's home court, and the environment was hostile. What O'Neill later found was that Bugliosi had built a legacy of threatening journalists who challenged him. At one point, the famed prosecutor had told Mary Nicewander that he knew where her children attended school and it would be very easy to plant narcotics in their lockers. But, as author Jim DiEugenio points out, what was the famous prosecutor so worried about? What secrets was he so desperately trying to protect? O'Neill answers those questions adeptly in the strongest section of Chaos, his repudiation of Bugliosi as a prosecutor, an historian, and the author of anything true regarding the crime genre. One of the most egregious was his handling of Atkins and Linda Kasabian. Atkins had been talking while detained. Reportedly, she had talked to at least four others about a case. Bugliosi wanted her to talk and to say what he wanted said to the grand jury. He, therefore, and with the judge's agreement, arranged to have Atkins's attorney replaced by one who was more favorable to the prosecution, Richard Caballero, who had spent 8 years in the DA's office. Atkins's new attorney got her to talk without any written or verbal agreement. Not only did this help buoy what would become the Helter Skelter myth, but it also brought Manson's name into the case for the first time. Atkins later reneged on many of the plot points in the story, including the satanic ones such as drinking the blood of murdered actress Sharon Tate. When Kasabian proved to be a better witness for the trial itself, she had not participated in the Gary Hinman murder, as Atkins had. Atkins was disregarded and cast away, something Caballero couldn't challenge without a written agreement, and something he wouldn't have challenged anyway, as his position alone was initiated so that Atkins would be agreeable to the prosecution's goals. Manson historian Nicholas Schreck, the author of The Manson File, has long argued that the Tate-LaBianca murders were a series of drug deals gone bad. O'Neill strongly agrees with this, as well, highlighting how Bugliosi detached Harry Melcher, son of actress Doris Day, and any links to the mob-influenced Southern California drug culture from Manson, thus leaving the defendants with no case. In the words of Krenwinkel attorney Paul Fitzgerald, Bugliosi wrote a script that he and Atlee Kelly maneuvered his witnesses to follow. Once O'Neill dismantles the structure of Bugliosi's case and the deceitfulness of his methods, he and co-author Dan Pepin attempt to write a detective story of what Manson, his family, and the case really were. Because it is all informed speculation at this point, as O'Neill readily admits, it doesn't have the same effect in destroying historical mythology as exposing Bugliosi's. Yet, the sections on the CIA, mind control at Vacaville Prison Medical Facility, COINTELPRO, and Ronald Reagan's California still ring fascinating. O'Neill's book also has value for anyone interested in the differences in the members of the family, as they are stark and surprising. O'Neill has done something unheard of in modern historical analysis. He has gotten the mainstream media to look at an accepted case in a different way. That is the power of Chaos, and for this, it will remain one of the single most important tomes ever written on the Tate-LaBianca murders, on Manson, and on the individuals who gathered seeking a different life on Span Ranch. American Public Getting Tired of Dishonest Left-Wing Activism, by John Friend. Our radical far left-wing media outlet Think Progress, which is connected to the far left activist group Center for American Progress, CAP, is shutting down. largely due to the fact that the overwhelming majority of Americans can't stomach the organization's hyperpartisan woke agenda. The demise of the Trump-bashing, hyperpartisan left-wing media outlet comes as no surprise to astute followers of American politics and media. The left-wing outlet has admittedly run on a deficit for years, hemorrhaging funds, resources, and credibility with each passing day. Officials at CAP, which oversaw Think Progress, had been searching for a buyer to take over the progressive media outlet but were ultimately unsuccessful. Given that we could find no new publisher, we have no other real option but to fold the Think Progress website back into CAP's broader online presence with a focus on analysis of policy, politics, and news events through the lens of existing CAP and CAP Action staff experts. Navin Nayak, the executive director of the Center for American Progress Action Fund, explained in a statement to the media following the announcement of the demise of Think Progress, "Conversations on how to do so are just beginning, but we will seek to reinvent it as a different platform for progressive change." About 12 people will lose their jobs at Think Progress, it was reported. The actual website for Think Progress, thinkprogress.org, will continue to exist but not as an independent media outlet dedicated to advancing left-wing issues as it had previously. The announcement of the demise of the outlet comes as more and more Americans continue to recognize the highly partisan, dishonest nature of many left-wing publications, whose primary focus for the past 4 years has been on discrediting and smearing President Donald Trump and his Make America Great Again agenda. Trump, for his part, has been vocal in condemning and attacking the fake news media, which he has powerfully argued is the enemy of the people in this country. Thankfully, independent media outlets such as American Free Press and content creators utilizing YouTube and other forms of social media continue to gain traction and credibility in the eyes of the American public. It is becoming more and more obvious that the most honest and hard-hitting journalism and analysis is coming from the independent media rather than mainstream corporate outlets. As independent media outlets and content creators online attract more attention and followers, the censorship agenda pursued by internet tech giants at the behest of anti-American, anti-free speech organizations such as the Anti-Defamation League and Southern Poverty Law Center has advanced as well. As this newspaper previously reported, many popular right-leaning independent analysts have been deplatformed by YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and other leading social media platforms, particularly in recent months. While the censorship and deplatforming campaigns carried out by tech giants intensifies, so, too, do the creative alternatives developed by those fighting for free speech and thought. The issue of online censorship, deplatforming, and freedom of speech is perhaps one of the most relevant political issues facing the American public as the 2020 presidential campaign approaches. Will American politicians of either political stripe address the topic and stand up for free speech in the First Amendment, or will they continue to hide in the shadows, too scared to risk taking a politically incorrect stand on this vital issue for fear they might become a target of loudmouth radical activist groups? Black Americans Should Thank Trump, by Robert Romano in 2016. When Donald Trump was campaigning, the appeal he made to Black Americans was a simple one: what have you got to lose? As it turns out, there was a whole lot for them to gain, including the best labor market conditions for blacks in U.S. history, with near 50-year low 3.7% unemployment nationwide. The rising tide in the Trump economy has been helping Americans of every race and background, including blacks. Since January 2017, 1 million more African Americans say they have jobs, up to now 19.4 million, the most ever. Only 1.1 million say they are unemployed, down from 1.5 million, even as the population increased by 1 million and those participating in the labor force increased by 600,000. In that time, the jobless rate for blacks has dropped from 7.7% to its lowest rate ever of 5.5% in August, according to data compiled by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Put another way, black unemployment is down almost a third from the last peak in labor markets in August 2007. Then, unemployment for blacks hit a low of 7.6%, before reaching 16.8% in March 2010. The rate settled to around 8% at the end of the Obama administration, and then began dropping in earnest the second half of 2017. This economic miracle comes as blacks, and non-blacks, too, today are the most educated in the history of America, a significant generational achievement. The percent of blacks 25 years old and above with some college and above increased from 50% in January 2012 to 56% in August 2019 at more than 15.4 million. Non-blacks who are 25 years old and above also increased college participation from 58.2% to 62.6%, up to 121.6 million. Generally, the greater the level of educational attainment, the lower the unemployment rate. The unemployment rates for African Americans with bachelor's degrees or higher or those with some college are as good today as in past business cycles. It's just that now there are more of them as a share of the population, leading to the lower unemployment rates we are witnessing today. In other words, younger Americans, including blacks, are studying harder and longer than previous generations, and is paying off with the most educated labor force in American history and the lowest unemployment levels in about 50 years. In 2019, the biggest area of improvement for all races including blacks has been the decrease of the unemployment rate for those with less than a high school diploma, which is much lower than prior cycles. Today, that stands at 5.4% nationwide. It's been around 5% since the beginning of 2018. The lowest before that was 5.8% in December 1999, but that was just for 1 month. Throughout the late 1990s, unemployment for those who didn't finish high school was in the 6% and 7% range. The significant increase in jobs for the least educated can partially be attributed to the dwindling number of those who don't finish high school, now down to 21.3 million from 26.2 million in January 2009. But that number has been collapsing for more than a generation. The fact is, the Trump economy is bringing opportunities to places that never had any, including those who didn't even finish high school, by integrating those who were not previously a part of the labor force. It's valuable experience.